Good evening. It's a blessing and a privilege to be able to open up 2024 Men's Canfield. Just grateful and thankful for this opportunity. As Marshall was alluding to, and I heard somebody kind of joking that my lesson's already kind of done, which it kind of was, because he asked me, he's like, hey, you know, I really appreciate that passage out of Nehemiah there, Nehemiah 4:14. And he gave me my topic, which was grow your faith in the face of fear. But in his text message, he's like, hey, you can bring some context if you want, so kind of like get the foundation set. And I jokingly replied back, I go, how much context do you want? I got 18 messages worth. He's like, well, you know, just kind of shorten that down a little bit. But I really appreciate the passage that he picked out, and there's so much going on there that we need to kind of understand the background to why Nehemiah is saying what he's saying, who he's saying it to. What situation are they finding fearful? What's going on in this day and age? And I think it's really appropriate maybe just to start back in Nehemiah chapter 1, kind of do a cliff note version of this just to be able to understand what's going on in chapter 4. I mean, Nehemiah really is in Jerusalem because of one question that he asked. And that question is asked in Nehemiah chapter 1. We'll read the first couple of verses here. The words of Nehemiah the son of Hechaliah, now it happened in the month of Chislev in the 20th year while I was in Susa the capital, that Hanani, one of my brothers, and some men from Judah came, and I asked them concerning the Jews who had escaped and had survived the captivity and about Jerusalem. And they said to me, the remnant there in the province who survived the captivity are in great distress and reproach, and the wall of Jerusalem is broken down, and its gates are burned with fire. So we open up inside the walls of the capital of the Persian Empire, Susa. Nehemiah resides in protection of these walls. He holds a very prominent position as cupbearer to King Artaxerxes. And what we notice right away with Nehemiah is he's not too interested in the place that he lives. He's not too interested in the position that he holds. Where his mindset really is focused on is a place and a people that are 800 miles away. A place and a people that he has never seen with the physical eyes. One of the things that we need to understand that what consumes our mind comes out in our conversation. And we see that very quickly with Nehemiah. Because he's asking, how is Jerusalem? I hear these people talking from Judah. They just came back. I want to know, how is Jerusalem? How are the people? And what he finds is devastating to him. You know, people aren't good. The walls are burned. Gates are torn down. Now, the condition of these city walls and gates may be what happened in the Babylonian siege in 586 B.C., 2 Kings 25 records how the Chaldeans burned the house of the Lord, broke down the walls around Jerusalem. Regardless, Nehemiah is devastated. And you look at verse 4 and see what his response is. Now it came about when I heard these words, I sat down and wept and mourned for days. And I was fasting and praying before the God of heaven. He was moved, mourning and praying. These feelings of sadness would not go away quickly. 4 months later, Nehemiah is performing his duties in front of King Artaxerxes. And the king notices something different about Nehemiah this day. I don't know if Nehemiah's thoughts may have been trailing off to Jerusalem, maybe some of the things that he's been searching out, studying. But his facial expression dropped. The king noticed it. From my understanding, it was forbidden to be sad in the presence of the king. Your personal life should not impact your service or your demeanor before the king. You should forget all your problems in his presence. On this particular day, Nehemiah could not hide back his sadness. His thoughts were on Jerusalem and on the people. The king questioned Nehemiah regarding his sadness. Nehemiah became afraid because he understood the position that he was in. But he took the chance. And he poured out his heart to the king. Go to Nehemiah chapter 2 and verse 3. See what he says before the king. And he said to the king, "Let the king live forever. Why should my face not be sad when the city, the place of my father's tombs, lies desolate and its gates have been consumed by fire?" He poured it all out there. He had nothing to hold back. The king's response, "What is your request?" You can see in the following verses that Nehemiah is really taking these last 4 months to understand what it would take to be successful to travel to Jerusalem. What it would take to rebuild these walls, rebuild these gates. In the following verses, he responds to the king and he knows his expected length of his journey, the route that he would travel to Jerusalem. He knows which governors he would need to have letters for, so he could give those letters to them so they would cooperate and not hinder his journey. And most importantly, he needs resources. He understands that he needs a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest. He needs timber to rebuild these gates. How does the king respond? Everything's been granted. He has been commissioned by a king with the support of God to move forward with his plan. Nehemiah leaves the safety of Susa behind him and starts making that 800-mile trip to Jerusalem, which is dangerous. Nehemiah is not traveling alone. The king has granted him some officers of the army, as well as horsemen. He sets out. One of the major landmarks that Nehemiah has to get past is the Euphrates River. It's a big milestone. Now, on the other side of the river, he presents some of his letters to the governors. He doesn't want to be bothered. He wants to keep moving right along. But he runs into a couple of guys. He runs into Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite. When they hear what he wants to do, where he's headed, they're not happy. They're not happy one bit. See, they don't want anybody to seek the welfare of the sons of Israel. They want the Jews to remain in the condition that they're in. See, they're very well aware of the condition of the walls, the conditions of the gates. They understand the magnitude of the project that's ahead of him. More than likely, this guy's not going to succeed. He may have a lot of ambition. I don't think it's going to happen. Again, they want to see the city remain in the vulnerable state that it's in. Nehemiah continues on, unhindered. As time goes by, miles go by. Eventually, Nehemiah and these men that are accompanying him make their way to Jerusalem. They enter into the gates. Remember who Nehemiah is. He's a Persian royal official, cupbearer to the king. He has officers with him, horsemen with him. You think this guy might get a little attention going into the gates? I mean, he could have very easily come into town like a wrecking ball, waving these letters around, showing them that he's got the approval of the king to do this, that, and all these other things. Listen to me, because I got something to say. We're going to rebuild these walls. We're going to rebuild these gates. How would that go over to those who've been living in Jerusalem this whole time? Wouldn't go over well at all. See, he needs to have these people's support in order to do what he needs to do. But right now is not the time to reveal to them what his intentions are. He wants the dust to settle. He wants to give it a few days so maybe his traveling around Jerusalem will go unnoticed. But there will be a time that he will reveal his intentions. So he waits a couple days. It says in the scriptures, on the third night of his arrival, Nehemiah rises in the middle of the night to inspect the walls. See, he needs to personally understand what he's up against. He needs to understand any potential obstacles he faces. You can tell from Nehemiah's character, this is a man of planning. He didn't rush right into the king's presence and say, "I want to go back to Jerusalem." He took months to figure out what he needed to be successful. The same thing is here. He's formulating a plan as he goes about the walls. He needs to understand what truly was going on here. what it's going to take to rebuild these walls, what obstacles he has. He wants to be able to have this firsthand investigation, so when he presents his findings, what he's going to do to the people, he can encourage them. He can have their buy-in. Anybody that has fears, he can calm them. Eventually, his investigation is complete. Now it's time to approach the people and inform them of his intentions. Nehemiah chapter 2, verse 17 and 18. Then I said to them, "You see the bad situation we are in? That Jerusalem is desolate, its gates are burned by fire. Come, let us rebuild the walls of Jerusalem that we may no longer be a reproach." And I told him how the hand of my God had been favorable to me, and also about the king's words which he had spoken to me. Then he said, "Let us arise and build." So they put their hands to the good work. Nehemiah approaches them. He's got three components to this speech. First, he wants to talk about the problem. He says, "You see the bad situation that we are in?" You notice he didn't exclude himself. He's in these torn down gates and walls with the rest of them. "You see the bad situation that we are in? That Jerusalem is desolate? Its gates are burned by fire?" Why would he state the obvious? I mean, these people have been growing up in this situation for years. They understand the condition of these walls. They understand when they go through the gates. Why point out the obvious? Because they've grown accustomed to torn down walls. They've learned to live with the danger and the inconveniences. This is their life. He moves on to the solution. See, nobody opposed the fact that the walls were torn down, the gates been burned. He established the problem. Let's propose a solution. He says, "Come, let us rebuild the walls of Jerusalem." It's a clear solution. A walled city would be great benefit to these people. All the positives that would happen in their lives, they would not be hindered by their enemies. They could probably start seeing it in their mind's eye, what this would look like, the benefits. The last thing, the last component, the reason something must be done now. Not next month, not next year. We're not doing a 5-year plan. We need to do this now. He says, "Come, let's rebuild the walls of Jerusalem that we may no longer be a reproach." The people of Jerusalem have been able to ignore what has been so evident to surrounding nations. Broken walls symbolize a defeated city. What does their current condition communicate to others about God? Israel is not just another nation. Their role was unique among nations. God established them as a nation through which he would demonstrate his power, his glory, and his grace. This was a place that God chose to have his name. Nehemiah challenged them that day. He wanted to remind them who you are and where you are. You are God's people and God's city. How would they respond? They said, "Let us arise and build." These people had a mind to work. Nehemiah chapter 3 gives us a list of the people and some of the groups that were so willing to put their hand to the work. You'll see governors, priests, Levites, goldsmiths, perfumers, just to name a few. I don't see any builders. I don't see any general contractors listed. I see people that are willing to be used. The enemy is not happy with the response of the people. Sanballat the Horonite, Tobiah the Ammonite, and Geshem the Arab mocked and despised the builders' efforts. Nehemiah and the builders are well aware of their disapproval. They've heard the discouraging words that have been directed towards them. "The Jews are feeble. Their efforts won't amount to much," says Sanballat. Tobiah has to jump right in there and mock their efforts as well. He says, "Even if a fox were to jump on it, he would break their stone wall down." Why are you doing this? It's not going to be successful. Nehemiah has no control over those who oppose him. The only thing he has control over is his own attitude and how he responds to the opposition. Each time he hears ridicule, he does the only thing he can. He prays about the situation and leaves it in God's hands. Because he knows what their ultimate goal is. He knows their goal is to stop the builders from completing the wall. Nehemiah chapter 4. The builders are about halfway done with the wall. They've made significant progress in a short amount of time. Altogether, it's going to take them 52 days to complete this wall. What you need to understand is this wall, on average, is 40 foot tall and 8 foot thick. Again, this was just a big job ahead of them. Up to this point, the words of discouragement and doubt directed towards the builders fell short of their intended goal. They would not stop. In portions of the scripture, they appear to waver in their efforts, but they do not completely stop what they're doing. In the face of adversity, the builders continue their efforts. Sanballat and Tobiah are not the only ones who do not want to see the Jews succeed. You need to understand that the Jews are in a position in Jerusalem where they have enemies on all sides. They got Arabs to the south, Samaritans to the north, Ammonites to the east, Ashdodites to the west. They do not want to see this city gain strength. They want to see it weak and vulnerable. There's a growing external pressure for the Jews to stop. When words aren't going to do it, it's going to turn physical. Nehemiah chapter 4, verse 11. And our enemies said, they will not know or see until we come among them, kill them, and put a stop to the work. And it came about when the Jews who lived near them came and told us 10 times they will come up against us from every place where you may turn. Then I stationed men in the lowest parts of the space between the wall, the exposed places, and I stationed the people and families with their swords, their spears, and their bows. It would appear an attack is imminent. Again, the words just aren't doing it. They need to ramp it up. It's going to start getting physical. Was this going to stop Nehemiah? See, he's been commissioned by a king to do this work. But more importantly, he has the backing of God. This was not going to hinder him one bit. If anything, this was going to strengthen him to push through. So he prepares for the fight. He groups the men together with their families. He starts putting them in the spots where it would be more convenient for these people to get in, the lowest parts of the wall. But as he's making preparations, as he's putting people in place, getting them ready for the fight, he notices something about them. He notices a fear in their eyes. Again, you need to understand, when you read Nehemiah chapter 3, I do not see trained soldiers, generals, in that list. I see everyday people just willing to be used. He is not leading trained men. These people are way out of their comfort zone. Way out of their comfort zone. And they have a right to be fearful. They see this attack coming. They heard the rumors. Things are not looking good. We've all experienced fear in our life. Fear is one of those 7 universal emotions that everybody has. We all know the unpleasant emotion caused by a belief that someone or something is dangerous, likely to cause us pain, or is a threat. Fear is both a natural emotion and a survival mechanism. When confronted with a perceived threat, their body responds in specific ways. Physical reactions include sweating, increased heart rate, high adrenaline levels that cause extreme alertness. A lot of us know this is called the flight fight or flight response in which your body's just preparing itself. It's either you're going to confront what's up against you, or you want to leave that danger in the rearview mirror. You want to get out of there as quick as possible. When I came was doing this lesson a while ago, I came upon three acronyms for fear that I want to share. The first one is false emotions appearing real. Those of us who live or have lived with anxiety and fear will argue that those emotions are not false, but instead are quite real. Now, I'm not here to minimize or dismiss any fear that you have. But you just think about it for a minute. There is truth and wisdom in what was just said. When anxiety or fear grips us, our mind often plays tricks on us. Things that perhaps aren't accurate in our mind seem very real. Our mind is anxious. The notion that our fear is completely real and justified may come from faulty thoughts. We think there's a threat when there really isn't one in reality. Second, forget everything and run. It's a component of the fight or flight response. We feel anxious, feel afraid. Our entire being screams just to get out of Dodge, get away from the situation. Fear makes our anxiety rev up, and our mind and our body prepare to flee. As we run, we do so to remove ourselves from a temporary situation. Thing is, we don't forget. Forget everything and run just turns into run. The final acronym, face everything and rise. Taking action is the only way to overcome our fear. Fear paralyzes. It keeps us from our goals and reaching our fullest potential. It's exactly what Sanballat and those were banking on, that these people are going to be fearful. They're going to be paralyzed, and they didn't want to fight back. It would have been an easy victory. It's not easy to face our fears. It takes effort on our part to take time to recognize our thoughts and begin to challenge them. When we do this, we are truly facing our fears. We rise above the fear and the anxiety that once paralyzed us. We need to recognize that feeling fear and living in fear are two different things. Allowing fear to paralyze you so you can't reach your fullest potential would be living in fear. We are the ones to give power to that fear. We are the ones that dwell on that. No one else. Fear is a mental roadblock that some people just will never allow themselves to get past. It's true. I've known people in my past that this fear, they just stop dead in their tracks. They will not allow themselves to challenge their thoughts or move forward. There's a quote I appreciate by George Adair. He was a Atlanta real estate agent developer during the Civil War. And he said, "Everything you've ever wanted is on the other side of fear. In order to obtain that which we desire, we need to get out of our own way." See, there's a lot of things people fear in this world. Flying, I feared that for years. Heights, public speaking, enclosed spaces, spiders, mice, dogs, snakes, storms. You fill in the blank. Could go on and on about things that people are fearful of, get paralyzed with. But what is the one thing that the majority of people are fearful of? Death. Death. That is one that will stop most people. They just don't want to face it. They don't want to deal with it. They do everything in their lives to avoid those thoughts. One thing in our society that you will recognize very quickly is, well, back in the day, when you had grandparents that were getting older, they actually took care of those people in their house. Those people that usually pass away in their house. They usually have to face death in their house. their kids would have to see that. Grandpa, mom, or dad getting sick and passing away in the house. Well, what does our current culture do? They start getting sick. They put them away in a nursing home. They may visit once in a while, but they don't want to face the reality of the situation. There's a lot of people in this world that will do that. Billionaire Brian Johnson is taking part in a project called Blueprint Protocol. Some of you may be aware of this gentleman, what he's trying to do. What he's trying to do is he's trying to do the anti-aging routine that's putting him, he's putting himself through an anti-aging routine to reverse his biological age. He's currently 46 from last time I read this article, but he's striving to have a biological age of 18. Again, this guy's a billionaire. It's costing him upwards and over probably $2 million a year to put himself through these radical choices. His last meal a day is at 11 a.m. He takes more than 100 supplements a day, blood plasma transfusions, microneedling, full body LED exposure, MRI scans, and a vast array of other things that I just didn't want to get into. But he's putting himself through the ringer. His goal? To make death an option. He's not the first guy that had this idea. For thousands of years, you know, there's been talk about a fountain of youth. You know, a magical spring that restores youth to anyone who drinks it or bathes in the water. Juan Ponce de Leon, a Spanish explorer, supposedly searching for the fountain of youth when he traveled to present-day Florida in 1513. There is no difference between the billionaire and spending the money and what Ponce de Leon was looking after. They want to get out of death. The question becomes, why are so many people so willing to go to such great lengths to avoid death? Could it be the fear of the unknown? What happens truly when you take your last breath? What if there is a way to take the sting away from death? To take away the fear of the unknown? Maybe, just maybe, a firsthand account of someone who came back from the dead. Revelation chapter 1. Revelation chapter 1. Verses 17 and 18. And when I saw him, I fell at his feet as a dead man. And he laid his right hand upon me, saying, "Do not be afraid. I am the first and the last and the living one. And I was dead, and behold, I am alive forevermore. And I have the keys of death and of Hades." There is one who conquered death. Through his written word, he has given us the opportunity to understand and have hope after this life. In Luke 16, Jesus gives us an account of the rich man and Lazarus. Some people want to say this is a parable. But in parables, Jesus never uses names. It's usually pretty vague. But this is a parable that talks about the rich man and Lazarus. Well, let's turn there. Luke 16. Start in verse 19. "Now there's a certain rich man. He habitually dressed in purple and fine linen, gaily living in splendor every day. And a certain poor man named Lazarus was laid at his gate covered with sores and longing to be fed with the crumbs which were falling from the rich man's table. Besides, even the dogs were coming and licking his sores. Now it came about that the poor man died, and he was carried away by the angels to Abraham's bosom. And the rich man also died and was buried. And in Hades he lifted up his eyes, beholding, being in torment, and saw Abram from far away and Lazarus in the bosom. And he cried out and said, 'Father Abram, have mercy on me, and send Lazarus, that he may dip the tip of his finger in water and cool off my tongue, for I am in agony in this flame. That's pretty prideful to be in agony and still thinking you can boss Lazarus around. That's just saying a lot about his character. Verse 25. But Abraham said, Child, remember that during your life you received your good things, and likewise Lazarus bad things. But now he's being comforted here, and you are in the agony. And besides all this, between us and you, there is a great chasm fixed, in order that those who wish to come over from here, you may not be able to, and that none may cross over from there to us. And he said, Then I beg you, Father, that you may send him to my father's house. For I have five brothers, they may warn them, lest they also come to this place of torment. Abraham said, They have Moses and the prophets, let them hear them. He said, No, Father Abraham, no, but if someone goes to them from the dead, they will repent. But he said, If they do not listen to Moses and the prophets, neither will they be persuaded if someone rises from the dead. You can see very quickly where your choices will get you. The senior Mr. Harbor used to say, smoking or none. Kind of think it's funny until it's reality. See, choices for one led into paradise. Choices for the other led into Hades. And between the two, there's a great chasm that nobody could cross. And it remained that way until Jesus took paradise up. You can see that in Ephesians chapter 4. Ephesians chapter 4, verse 8. Therefore it says, When he ascended on high, he led captive a host of captives. He gave gifts to men. Now this expression, he ascended, what does it mean except that he also had descended into the lower parts of the earth? He who descended is himself also who ascended far above all the heavens, that he might fill all things. Jesus took paradise up. Paul confirms that paradise is up when he referred to his near-death experience or his death experience in the epistle to the Corinth church. That's in 2 Corinthians 12, 3 and 4. The New Testament writings also speak of the day of the Lord was comes like a thief in the night. What happens on that day? Let's go to 2 Peter. These things were written for our comfort, so we understand what happens. That which was once unknown becomes known to those who are willing to seek it out. 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 10. But in the day of the Lord which comes like a thief, in which the heavens will pass away like a roar, and the elements will be destroyed with intense heat, and the earth and its works will be burned up. Since all these things are to be destroyed in this way, what sort of people ought you to be in the holy conduct and godliness? Looking for and hastening the coming of the day of God, on account which the heavens will be destroyed by burning, and the elements will melt with intense heat. I got curious one day. I want to know how hot was hot. How hot are we talking for the elements to melt away? So I quickly Googled to see which was the metal that had the highest melting point. And I was shocked. 6,150 degrees, tungsten starts to melt. That gives you an idea how hot is going to get when the elements melt away. Paul gives us more info about the coming of our Lord. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. Start in verse 13. But we don't want you to be uninformed, brethren, about those who are asleep, that you may not grieve, and do the rest have no hope. For if we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so God will bring with him those who have fallen asleep in Jesus. For this we say to you by the word of the Lord, that we who are alive and remain until the coming of the Lord shall not precede those who have fallen asleep. For the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of the archangel, with the trumpet of God, and the dead in Christ shall rise first. Then we who are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and thus we shall always be with the Lord. There's going to be those who are alive and remain and be caught up to meet the Lord in the air. In order for something to remain, something has to go. Let's see, Matthew chapter 13. Jesus confirms, or Paul confirms what Jesus has to say here. Matthew 13. Start in verse 24. He presented another parable to them, saying, "The kingdom of heaven may be compared to a man who sowed good seed in his field. While men were sleeping, his enemy came and sowed tares also among the wheat and went away. But when the wheat sprang up and bore grain, then the tares became evident also. And the slaves of the landowner came and said to him, 'Sir, you not sow good seed in your field? How then does it have tares?' And he said to them, 'An enemy has done this.' And the slaves said to him, 'Do you want us then to go and gather them up?' He said, 'No, lest while you are gathering up the tares, you may root up the wheat with them. Allow both to grow together until the harvest. And in the time of the harvest, I will say to the reapers, first gather up the tares and bind them in the bundles to burn them up, but gather the wheat into my barn.'" He talks about how this is explained. Start in verse 36. "Then he left the multitudes and went into the house, and his disciples came to him, saying, 'Explain to us the parable of the tares of the field.'" They wanted to know what was up. He's going to explain to them. "He answered and said, 'To the one who sows the good seed of the Son of Man, and the field is the world, and as for the good seed, those who are the sons of the kingdom, and the tares are the sons of the evil one. The enemy who sowed them is the devil, and the harvest is in the end of the age, and the reapers are angels. Therefore, just as the tares are gathered up and burned with fire, so shall it be at the end of the age. The Son of Man will send forth his angels, and they will gather up out of his kingdom all stumbling blocks, and those who commit lawlessness, and will cast them into the furnace of fire. Into that place there shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Then the righteous will shine forth as a sun in the kingdom of their Father. He who has ears, let him hear." You want to remain. You don't want to be the first to go. That's what that boils down to. Wrapping this up, go to 2 Thessalonians. Paul has some more things to say here. 2 Thessalonians, chapter 1, verses 6 through 10. "For after all, it is only just for God to repay with affliction those who afflict you, and to give relief to you who are afflicted, and to us as well, when the Lord Jesus shall be revealed from heaven with his mighty angels in flaming fire, dealing out retribution to those who do not know God and those who do not obey the gospel of our Lord Jesus. And these will pay the penalty of eternal destruction away from the presence of the Lord and from the glory of his power, when he comes to be glorified in his saints on that day and be marveled at among all those who have believed, for our testimony to you was believed." We need to obey the gospel and know our Father. These things were wrote down so we have confidence in the message. When we have confidence in this message, that destroys the fear of death. We should not be paralyzed. We should not be hindered by the fact that there's going to be a day when you take your last breath if he hasn't returned at that time. And all those who are victorious on that final day will say, "Oh death, where is your victory? Oh death, where is your sting?" We need to keep these thoughts at the forefront of our mind and encourage others with them. Our God is faithful. Our God is awesome. I love the Old Testament. I enjoy reading it. I love seeing how he's true with everything he says. Why would he not be true with these things? Study them out. Understand them. Have confidence in them. Know who you are. Know where you reside. Know who your Father is. grow your faith in the face of fear by having confidence in the message. I know I've covered a lot tonight. I want to read one more verse, and I'll be done. Go to Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 41. Isaiah 41, I want to start in verse 10. Do not fear, for I am with you. Do not anxiously look about you, for I am your God. I will strengthen you. Surely, I will help you. Surely, I will uphold you with my righteous right hand. Behold, all those who are angered at you will be shamed and dishonored. Those who contend with you will be as nothing and will perish. You will seek those who quarrel with you, but will not find them. Those who war with you will be as nothing and non-existent. For I am the Lord your God, who upholds your right hand, who says to you, do not fear, I will help you. Thank you for your attention.